Welcome to the Andy Stanley Leadership Podcast, a conversation designed to help leaders go further faster. Today on the podcast, we'll be bringing you an interview that Andy conducted for our friends at Catalyst with author Charles Duhigg. This will continue a conversation we began back in September as Andy explored the idea of keystone habits. Without further delay, here's Andy and Charles.
Hi, I'm Andy Stanley, and I'm sitting here with my brand new friend, Charles Duhigg, with his not-so-brand new book. It's been out 2 years.
About 2 years,
The Power of Habit. I read it the year that it came out. I absolutely love this book. I bet there's some of you who have it, but you're not in the habit of reading. And so one of the first habits you should develop is the habit of reading. This is a fantastic book, and so we're going to talk a little bit about it. But our goal is for basically this conversation to sort of bait you into or to whet your appetite for wanting to read more about this extraordinary topic that's relevant to all of us. And this is a research-based book. This isn't simply someone's opinion. I love this book. I'll tell you why in just a minute. But to get started, Charles, in your book, you make the point that I think, 45% of all of our activities, good or bad, are somehow related to habit.
Absolutely. And you can recognize it when you start looking at your life, right? You become accustomed to these things that you do without thinking about.
For example,
you're sitting at your desk and you remember leaving the house, and now you're at your desk and you don't remember exactly how you drove there, right?
Or driving home from college.
Absolutely. Yeah. Or when you in the morning you want to eat a salad, and you hit the cafeteria lunchtime and you go get the sandwich that you get every single day. What happens is that our brain has this instinct to make anything we do on a regular basis into a habit. It wants to create habits because it's so much more cognitively easy, right? Mm-hmm. Our brain wants to save energy. And if it can figure out how to turn patterns into habits where we get to stop thinking, where we get to think about something else, it'll latch on and it'll do that as much as it can.
We're at a Catalyst event, and today when you presented, you gave the illustration of the lab rats that when they had to figure out a maze, their brain activity was high. Once they figured it out, there was this dip. It became talk about that a little bit.
Absolutely,
I think that's super relevant.
And this is the origin of what's known as the habit loop, right? Which is kind of this understanding of how habits work in our brains. When researchers would drop rats in this maze, the first time it would be thinking hard the entire time. But what happened is, as it ran that maze again and again and again, as running through the maze became a habit, they found that its brain started working less and less and less. Basically, when something becomes a habit, we stop thinking.
Wow.
And the reason why this is important is because our brain is actually very well designed to do this, because it relies on a couple things. At the beginning of a habit, and every habit has these three components. At the beginning of the habit, there's a cue, which is like a trigger, right? That tells your brain, you can go into automatic mode, you get to turn off now. And that cue can be a time of day, it can be a certain person, it can be
an algebra class.
Yeah. Absolutely.
All my math classes were that way.
Where your brain turned off. It's amazing how powerful they are. But then at the end of the habit, when the rat would find the chocolate in the maze, or when you make it to your office at work, there's a reward. There's something that allows your brain to say, okay, it's time to turn back on now, and I'm going to remember this pattern for the future because it gives me something that I want.
So there's cue, behavior, reward.
Exactly.
Cue, behavior, reward. And for those of you who are new to this topic, that's essentially the thrust of this book, because throughout the book, you basically take different areas of life, business, personal, bad habits, good habits, and look at it through that grid. And that's what makes this so extraordinarily helpful. Yeah, other illustrations.
Well, so some of the other habits that are very interesting, right, is one of them is nail biting. Like we think about nail biting as a habit. We think about having control over it. What's really interesting is when they've studied people why they bite their nails, they find that the cue is that people are anxious or they're bored. So what they do is they unconsciously, and anyone who's watching as a nail biter knows this, they lift their finger up to their mouth, they bite a little bit, and it causes this brief burst of pain. And that burst of pain neurologically is strong enough to overwhelm anxiety or to overwhelm boredom just for a split second.
Wow.
So we're not accustomed to thinking about pain as a reward, but in this case, our brain actually latches onto the pain. It prefers that pain.
Over the anxiety,
over the boredom. And that's why we get that habit. And the lesson here is...
Is there a reward? Is the reward the distraction from the pain?
The reward is the distraction from the pain, right? Oh. Or the pain is providing distraction from the boredom and from the anxiety.
Gotcha.
The lesson here that's kind of interesting is rewards can be really surprising, right? When you think about a habit you want to change, or you think about a habit you want to create, you have to figure out what that reward is that's driving the behavior. Take exercise. In experiments, when they've told people to give themselves a small piece of chocolate after they work out or go for a run.
Immediately after,
people end up exercising more. It's easier to create that exercise habit. But most of us think about how we actually exercise. We wake up in the morning, we go for a run, now we're running late for work, so we rush through our shower, we rush to get the kids out the door, we're anxious about getting to work. We're essentially punishing ourselves for exercising.
Wow.
And that's why it's so hard to make it into a habit. But if you find a reward and you let yourself enjoy it, then you're going to encourage the neurology.
My wife is one of the most, is the most consistent exerciser of anyone I've ever met. And she hides chocolate all over the house. Honestly, and I've never put these two together. And when I go home today, I'm going to say, I'm so glad you exercise and you don't overeat chocolate. But I've never understood why you hide it. I think I know. I think that's her reward, and she's never told me.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
That's really, really interesting.
That's true. I'm not just making that up.
Huh. Yeah.
So anyway, this book is extraordinarily helpful on a personal level. For those of us who work with people, either parachurch organizations, church, counseling, whatever, talk a little bit about how we can use this to actually help other people. Because the first takeaway for me is I immediately think of my bad habits or my good habits. But then I think about, wow, if I could teach my kids this, if I could teach parishioners this, how do those two worlds intersect?
So I think there's two important ways that we can help other people. The first is, if someone comes to them and they say, I'm doing this thing and I don't understand why, right?
Wow.
I'm gambling and I don't want to gamble. I'm going online and I don't want to waste time online. I'm cutting.
Fingernail biting.
I'm smoking.
Yep.
One of the most powerful things we can do is to sit down with them and say, look, I'm not going to judge you. I want you to know this is an environment where you are welcome. Let's try and diagnose what's actually going on. Let's go through what are the possible cues, right? If you are cutting, if you're going online, if you're gambling, what sets it off? Like, what's that moment that you feel that impulse? And it's going to be pretty obvious. They're going to be able to answer that question, right? It's not that we don't know what the cue is. It's that until someone forces us to draw attention to it, our brain turns off during a habit. We're not paying attention.
So you think for most people, 5 or 10 minutes of reflection, they can discover the cue on their own?
They can oftentimes figure out the general area, right? All cues fall into one of five categories. It's a time of day. It's a particular place. It's a certain emotion. Mm-hmm. It's certain other people. Or it's a preceding behavior that's become ritualized.
You got to do those again.
Sure.
So these are the five things that generally are associated with a cue.
With a cue.
A time of day.
A particular place, right? So afternoon munchies, time of day. A particular place you walk into the mall, you always overspend, it's the mall. Presence of certain other people. I always have a beer with Jim. Jim's my cue for a beer. A certain emotion. Whenever I'm stressed, I end up eating cookies. Or a preceding behavior that's become kind of ritualized.
For example?
For example, if you've gotten into the pattern of having a cup of coffee right before you go into a meeting. Mm-hmm. It's that something about that meeting has become a ritual. That you,
gotcha.
You brush your teeth in the morning after getting out of the shower.
So most people with just the... the three pieces of the cycle, taking some time to think about the cue, and then with those five prompters you just gave us, probably most people could identify the cue.
90% of people are going to be able to say, here's my cue. Actually, now that I think about it, but let's say you can't. Let's say you struggle with that. Nail biting is a good example because people bite their nail all the time. There's a method called habit reversal therapy where what they tell you to do...
Habit reversal therapy. Now, did you make that up?
No,
or is
no,
this
no,
a real
no.
thing?
No, it's a real thing. Okay. It's a real thing. You carry around like an index card. Anytime you feel the urge to bite your nails or anything else, just pull out the card and make a check. Because what you're trying to do is you're trying to just make yourself presently aware for just a moment. And you're going to figure out pretty quickly,
wow,
I keep on biting my nails when I'm bored, or I keep on biting my nails when I'm worried. Simply making that check just causes you to kind of pay attention a little bit more to what's going on. It's not going to take many days to figure out what the cue is. Unfortunately, that's probably the easiest part, right?
Yeah, identifying the cue.
Identifying the cue. So you've got the cue, which is triggering the behavior. You've got the behavior itself, and we know what that is because it's the habit
you're
trying to change. Now the reward. So if you're trying to create a new habit, the number one rule is you have to give yourself a reward and let yourself enjoy it.
If you're breaking an old habit or just creating a new
habit? Just creating a new habit. So if you're creating a new habit, you want to start exercising, you want to start being more present with your children, mm-hmm. when you do that thing, give yourself a reward right away, small piece of chocolate.
When you do the thing you're trying to get in the habit of doing.
Exactly.
The chocolate after I run.
Chocolate after I run. When I spend 10 minutes with my kids, pat myself on the back and let myself and go have a beer because you deserve it.
Right. But not with your children.
Not with your
children. Preferably. Well. Unless they're adult children.
Yes. Right. Unless. Right.
But this whole idea of pre-identifying a reward, because we all know what's rewarding to us personally, but attaching a reward to a behavior that's a behavior we're trying to create.
Exactly.
That's a pretty powerful idea.
And most people don't do that, right? Because we, as a culture, we're kind of stoic. We say, oh, I should go for a run just because the run is rewarding.
Right. Virtue is... There's no,
it's
we don't
its own
need a reward
for, right?
Virtue is its own reward, right?
But the truth of the matter is that if you want your neurology to lapse onto that pattern, you have to give yourself a reward you actually enjoy. At first, virtue is not its own reward.
Right.
Unless you let yourself, tell yourself, you should be really proud. You should pat yourself on the back. And pride can be a reward as much as a piece of chocolate.
But a piece of chocolate is, or something like it, is a tangible thing I have to look forward
That's
to.
That's the nice thing.
When you were sharing that today, I thought about, I have... an immediate when I finish exercising after I work out, I immediately go upstairs and I get something to eat, and it's not chocolate, but it's always something that's it's not a guilty pleasure, but it's and I look forward to that, and so I really do think my wife hides chocolate to reward herself after she exercises, which is great. Switching gears for just a minute,
sure.
In section 2 or chapter 4 of this book, you talk about Keystone Habits. We actually spent an entire podcast, the Andy Stanley Leadership Podcast, talking about Keystone Habits and how this book impacted our organization. So it's a thrill to be able to sit down with you, because I feel like I wish I had been able to talk to you before I did the podcast about your book. I gave it my best shot. But talk a little bit about, if you can, just organizational habits as it relates to Keystone Habits. Maybe if you want to retell the Alcoa story, which is such a powerful story. But for organizational leaders especially, the whole idea of recognizing, because every organization has habits, and I'd never really thought about that. I mean, I know I have habits. I know the people I work with have habits. But our organization does the same way, the same thing all the time.
And absolutely.
And that's important. You have to have systems. But in terms of identifying an organizational keystone habit that could drive other good behaviors in an organization, that's a powerful thought. What have you learned? What have you seen?
Well,
have you seen people apply
it's interesting.
That?
So every organization has habits, right? We know this when we start thinking about it. And studies have shown this, right? There's the rule book that tells you how to do things, and then there's the way things really get done.
Right.
I go, I'm going to talk to this assistant because I know she has more power than everyone else. I'm going to present an idea this way because I know that's how the culture of the organization. And what's interesting is that those habits can be dysfunctional, right? Silos can develop.
Yep.
There can be dysfunctional ways of communication. They can bring down an organization. And so when you find a keystone habit, a habit that has a disproportionate impact on the culture of an organization.
That this is a big phrase, a disproportionate impact on the culture of an organization.
Right.
This is huge, because that's this section of the book, the whole idea of discovering one habit that has a disproportional impact on the culture of an organization. I just think it's a big, big idea. I interrupted you. I just want our audience to know this. I think this is huge. Keep going.
Well, and it's interesting because I'm glad you did, because this idea that one habit can have a disproportionate impact, it's important because it sets off a chain reaction. It changes how you behave in other ways. I know when we were talking, you had said that you felt like a keystone habit for the church was inviting new members.
Yeah,
to
we
come.
Call it invest and invite. Invest in relationships, invite people to a service or to an event designed for them. Yeah.
And it makes total sense to me that would be a trigger for really important things within the community, growing the community, talking about the community. But what's also interesting to me about that, and I'd be curious if this is true, is my guess is that inviting someone who you haven't met before to come to your church.
Or someone you know. Either way.
That's a little scary,
it's
right?
It's like exercise.
Yeah.
I should, but I'm not going to.
Right. We shy away from it, right?
Right.
With something, and that's a sign that it's a keystone habit. When we find things, changes we want to make in our life or in our company or in our kids' lives that should be easy to do, and we just keep on shying away from them, it's a sign that it's a keystone habit. It's a sign that if that changes, it'll set off a chain reaction.
That's powerful. In our case, when we had that discussion, we spent a couple of weeks talking about cues. In other words, if we were going to teach the people in our congregations to do, and this is something we've talked about since the beginning for 20 years, but the whole idea, what this book forced us to do or encouraged us to do, was we asked the question, what are the cues? Let's teach our people cues. And we came up with three cues. We call them the three knots. When you run into someone in the community who's not in church, that's the obvious one. for whom things are not going well, or they hear, I was not ready for that. When someone says, I was not ready for that. We had a baby, or, you know, I got married and I was not ready for that. Or somebody says, things are not going well. You know, I'm not doing well in school. My husband lost a job. Or you hear someone say, I'm not in church. So we've begun to teach the three knots as the cues to listen for, so that when you hear one of those knots, that's to cue you to invite someone to church. So we started doing this with our staff before we kind of rolled this out to our campuses. And even for me as the lead person in the organization, I have had two occasions where I found myself, and it's very difficult for me to invite because, like, come hear me preach. It's a right. little odd. You know, right. you love our church. The pastor's phenomenal. It's me. You know, it's a little bit awkward. But twice I have heard one of those three cues just in random conversation and found myself leaning
just automatically doing it.
So anyway, so that's one application. But in this case, we had to, I feel like, surface for people what those cues were, a bit like the Alcoa illustration, where the cue is, if there's an injury on the workplace, here's what we automatically do.
Absolutely. And what's really interesting about what you just said, that you're listening for someone saying, I was not prepared for that, or in Alcoa when people are getting injured. I think probably one of the reasons why it's such a powerful moment is that's someone's making an emotional admission, right? Yep. I was not prepared to get married. I was not prepared to have a kid. You're very vulnerable.
Not prepared for this new city. Not prepared for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's scary to say something like that. And when emotions are in play, that's when habits become most flexible. That's when with you turning to them, you're providing an incredible service to say, I hear you saying that a moment of vulnerability, I want to give you something that's helped me. Yeah. And that's a type of connection that it's really hard to make. And it's a type of connection that our brain latches onto.
Now what I've got to do that I've learned in this conversation and based on your presentation at Catalyst today was, we're going to have a big bowl of chocolate in the lobby, and I'm going to be able to say, if you invited someone to church today, go out there and get yourself a piece of chocolate.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, we haven't had a tangible reward. I mean, when we had this discussion, we really did talk a long time about what is the reward, and to your point, there was the, it should be enough to know that you've participated in the mission of the church and all those things, but we struggled with the, what is the tangible reward, and the idea of actually creating something tangible that's at the end of this process is so extremely important.
Oh, it's incredibly. And oftentimes, rewards don't have to be a big deal for them to be powerful, right? You just coming up and saying, I saw that you invited someone today. I just wanted to say thank you for inviting someone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That makes your whole week, right? To have Andy thank you, your pastor talk to you that way. The rewards don't have to be this thing that's incredibly valuable. They just have to give you a chance to say to yourself, you know what? I deserve to feel good right now. Mm-hmm. And your brain listens to you feeling that way.
So anything else in terms of systems, organizational leadership, as you think about what you've seen or maybe other illustrations in the book? Because I think this is such a big, you know, for point leaders, this is the kind of thing where, depending on the personality, they would say, well, I just need somebody to come and tell me what it is and we'll do it.
Right.
You know, I don't want to work through the process. I don't want to have that many meetings. That's that ooey-gooey side of organization that I don't have time for. You know, we have things to do. But I think, and if you read the book and you read that Alcoa illustration especially, you'll see the tangible value of someone who, I don't know if he accidentally stumbled onto this, you don't say, or it was strategic thinking on his part, but to find that one behavior that triggered so many other behaviors. What else can you say about that?
So the one other thing I would say, particularly for organizations, is when you are looking for that keystone habit, you have to look for something that embodies values. At Alcoa, which was this huge aluminum company, Paul O'Neill said, I'm not going to focus on profits. I'm not going to focus on efficiency. I'm going to focus on worker safety, changing worker safety habits. And it transformed the culture of the organization. And the reason why is because people were scared working there. It was factories. They were dangerous.
It was emotional.
And Paul O'Neill was saying, my values are to protect you. Mm-hmm. Then he goes to Treasury, becomes Secretary of Treasury under George W. Bush. The same thing, doesn't work there. Worker safety did not work at the Department of Treasury. And the reason why is because people who work at Treasury say, I'm not here for safety. I'm not here for that. I'm here to create policy. So when you're thinking about trying to diagnose the keystone habit in your own organization, you have to ask yourself, what are the values that cause people to actually walk through my door? What are they showing up because they want to make the world a better place, which I imagine a number of the people who work with you are, mm-hmm. because I have this mission to have more people hear God's word. in which case my Keystone Habits are going to be tied very closely into that mission. If I'm working in an investment bank, it's a completely different mindset, right? I'm working because I want to make markets more efficient. I want to streamline free commerce, in which case the Keystone Habits for an organization like that are going to be built around those values. And then once you identify that value, and it's a conversation, you can't figure it out on your own. You have to have a conversation with folks and say, what do you care about? What's scary? What do you worry about?
Well, and that's important. So say those three again. I know you probably just made them up off the top of your head, but I think this, when we had the discussion, that was the hard thing. All I knew about Keystone Habits is what I read in the book. And so this whole emotional piece, I think, is something that I probably didn't push as hard on in our discussion. So again, what do you,
when you come here, what do you care about? What's making you show up?
Right.
And what do you worry about?
What do you care about? What do you worry about?
Right. At Alcoa, people were worried they were going to get hurt. They weren't going to make it home. At Treasury, people were worried that they weren't going to create good policy. When they come to your church, I'm sure people say, I'm worried that I'm not going to live God's word as much as I can.
Yeah, in our case, so much of it is, I'm not sure that I'm a church person. I'm not sure I'll be welcome there.
That's
I'm not sure there's anything for me. Or I used to do that and it didn't work for me then. Why would I give it? So they're attending or reattending, we call them seeker starters and returners. A seeker starter or a returner coming back into any kind of church environment is very, very emotional for them. And to your point, I think for those of us who are there all the time, it is not emotional for us. There's not that tension. It's like, I know where to park, I know where to sit, I know where to drop off my kids. So this is a really powerful part of this discussion as we go back and think about, and again, I guess, discover or in some cases create Keystone Habits professionally.
Yeah, right. And the other thing I would say is, when you've gone through that journey and that process, and it's a conversation and it's always ongoing, you have to go out of your way to make it come alive, right? Mm-hmm. At Alcoa, at one point, there was a great vice president, did a really good job. Paula Newell had a habit, if you learn something, you have to share it with the organization. Mm-hmm. This guy learned something, he didn't share it with the organization, he got fired. Wow. It was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, it was a big deal. But the reason why Paula Newell did it is because he said, look, our Keystone Habit is improving worker safety and learning from mistakes.
I remember that.
And if you aren't part of that, you aren't part of our culture. And so it means that when you identify a Keystone Habit, you don't have to fire anyone. Hopefully it's a positive thing rather than a negative thing. But you say to people, as you see them living that habit, you say, look, you are the most important part of this church. You are the keystone of this church because you are doing what is at the core of our values. This Keystone Habit is where what allows everything else to thrive.
Mm. And what's rewarded is repeated. And we're not rewarding the right things, the wrong things.
Right.
Repeat it.
Exactly.
We've all seen that.
And it's very easy. I think you're exactly right. When it's very easy to fall into a pattern where everyone's doing great and you stop thanking them for doing the important small things.
Becomes expected.
Yeah.
Well, this is a fantastic book. And if any of this conversation kind of piqued your interest, I'm telling you, it is loaded. The section in there on Starbucks with the scripting of responses is so powerful. The section in there on gambling was an eye-opener to me. I mean, I've never been a gambler, but to see the depths in which there, or the links at which that industry goes to hook people was fascinating as well as discouraging. If you have kids, I promise you, you'll be about five pages into this book and think, how do I get my kids to read this? And your kids are 8 years old, and it's probably a little bit too early. But it is such a simple but not simplistic approach to something we all wrestle with personally, with people we work with, love, and are raising. And so what a gift to our culture and to our organization. So thanks so much, and thanks for being a part.
Thank you
podcast.
For having me. It's such a pleasure to be here. I really
Absolutely.
Appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us today. To hear more on this topic, please revisit the September Andy Stanley Leadership Podcast. To hear more on leadership from Andy, please visit andystanley.com.